You're listening to American Songcatcher, tracing the roots of American music from its cultured past to today's artists playing it forward. I'm folk musician Nicholas Edward Williams. As we will every February, this episode celebrates Black History Month. The following songs and musicians, past and present, have played a vital role in shaping not only African American culture, but people and places all over the world. Enjoy. On December 27th, 1895, in a tiny St. Louis saloon, two acquaintances were having a discussion that turned into an argument. That night, one of them ended up dead, while the other would be tried multiple times before being found guilty of murder. Though there were five other killings in St. Louis that same night, this single account would spark one of the most well-recorded turn-of-the-century blues standards, a song that, even today, is still ambling its way through musical revisions and lyrical adaptations. It's the story of Stagger Lee. If you will meet me in St. Louis, Louis, meet me at the fair. St. Louis in the late 1800s was a major manufacturing center. As the nation's fourth largest city, it dominated the region with easy access to railways and the transportation hub of the Mississippi River. With the rise of local breweries like Anheuser-Busch, who revolutionized the marketing and distribution of beer, to being one of the largest manufacturers of shoes in the country, as well as the city's innovative invention of cotton pressing, St. Louis was dubbed first in shoes, first in booze, and last in the American League, the latter of which referred to the St. Louis Browns baseball team. African-American history runs particularly deep in what is known as the Gateway to the West. Ever since St. Louis was taken by Europeans in 1764, African-Americans had been there. Among them, a very select few were free and a part of what was called the colored aristocracy. Some were free, owned land, and had skilled trade jobs, though most of them were already enslaved. When the United States took control of St. Louis from the French and Spanish in 1804, so-called black laws were enacted, with strict limitations on their fundamental rights, and conditions grew more tense. It took nearly half a century, but gradually, the number of free blacks continued to rise in the area. This was largely thanks to laws passed, such as the ability to self-purchase, as well as St. Louis's close proximity to Illinois, where slavery was illegal. A handful of captives were willingly freed by their owners, and several sued for their freedom because they had been taken to a free state for a period of time, which by law would grant them liberation. This was the case with the infamous Dred Scott trials, which began at the courthouse in downtown St. Louis during the mid-1800s, and has been long considered the major breaking point that led to the Civil War. At the time of the Dred Scott case, nearly one out of every 20 people living in St. Louis was African American, two-thirds of which were enslaved. By the late 1800s, with the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in the South, many African Americans made their way to cities like St. Louis, where assimilation was in full swing. By the late 1800s, ragtime had emerged as a new prominent musical style, with St. Louis as its hotbed. It was there that the father of ragtime, Scott Joplin, spent many of his formative years penning some of his best-known works, including March Majestic, The Ragtime Dance, and most famously, The Entertainer. Also during this time, the elite lineage of the colored aristocracy, who arrived with settlers a century prior, now owned large tracts of land, barber emporiums, and steamboat dredging businesses. The trickle-down economy gave rise to the African-American underworld elect, such as social groups like the 400 Club. Modeled after a group from New York City, 400 was a highbrow term for the number of people who really mattered and felt at home in the ballrooms and galas of high society. The 400 Club in St. Louis was for, quote, the moral and physical culture of young colored men. We contemplate no acts of violence, and as law-abiding citizens and voters, we stand ready and willing to protect the laws of our city, state, and the United States. The appointed captain of this 400 Club was a man named Lee Shelton, whom today we refer to as Stagger Lee, Stag Lee, or Stack Lee. An entrepreneur and part-time carriage driver, Lee was also a prominent member of the Max, a notorious group of pimps who wore flashy clothing, accessories, and famously, strutted. Well known around town, Lee owned an evening hotspot in the Red Light District, where ragtime and early blues flourished, called the Modern Horseshoe Club. When white visitors would arrive at the nearby railway station, Lee would either direct them to the Horseshoe using his own carriage service, or send them straight to the women that worked for him. When it came to fashion, Lee was extravagant, layering the finest fabrics, custom-made St. Louis-style low-heeled shoes with small mirrors on the bottom to catch light, gold rings, and a gold-topped cane with a lavish white Stetson hat. And despite Jim Crow laws that banned black people from living in neighborhoods that were 75% white, Lee had a big brick house in an upscale neighborhood, and business was good.
Stag Lee walked to the bar room and a cold glass of beer. He turned around to Bill Lyons and said, "What have you done here? Waiting for the train. Please bring them on."
The political scene in St. Louis during 1895 was tense. As one of the top five biggest cities in the country with a large black population, politicians chomped at the bit to get every vote, especially Republicans, who were losing their stronghold. In addition to being a high society social group, the 400 Club was a highly vocal supporter and organizer for the Democratic Party, with its headquarters at the Bill Curtis Saloon. 2 days after Christmas in 1895, Lee had a meeting there with an acquaintance named William Billy Lyons, who was a staunch Republican supporter that also did business in St. Louis's underworld. It's unclear what the purpose of their meeting was, but politics became the topic of discussion, and the situation got more and more heated.
I remember one September, on one Friday night, Stag Lee and Billy Lyons had a great fight. Cry when you lose your money, Lyons, to lose.
Fueled by alcohol, Lee put a dent in Billy's bowler hat, leading Billy to grab the expensive Stetson hat off of Lee's head. When Lee threatened to shoot Billy if he didn't give the hat back, Billy took out his pocket knife and yelled, "I'm going to make you kill me." Lee then hit Billy over the head with his .44 caliber Smith & Wesson, though it didn't stop Billy from coming at him. So Lee shot him in the abdomen, grabbed his Stetson hat, and said, "I told you to give me my hat," and slowly walked home. Billy would die from the gunshot wound by the following morning.
Now Stagger Lee, he shot Billy Lyon way down on that ballroom floor. Now Billy Lyon, mother, she come running. She said, "Lord, have mercy on my son."
Lee was soon arrested, and his trial received significant exposure from newspapers around the state. He hired one of the most prominent lawyers in Missouri, and the first trial resulted in a hung jury. In 1897, he was retried, found guilty of murder, and sentenced to Jefferson Penitentiary, which over half a century later would be infamously called the bloodiest 47 acres in America by Time magazine. After serving nearly 12 years, Lee was granted a full pardon on Thanksgiving Day by the governor of Missouri. Upon his release, it's unclear whether he knew it or not, but different versions of a song called Stagger Lee were popping up all over the South. 2 years after his release, Lee broke into a man's home, murdered him, and was again found guilty. Though just a year later, he again received a full pardon from the succeeding governor, reportedly because of political pressure. But before he was released, tuberculosis had taken its toll on Lee, and he died while incarcerated in 1912. The documentation of this story started with the St. Louis Globe-Democrat newspaper, whose article was published the day after the killing on December 28, 1895. 2 years later, a song called Stagger Lee, performed by Professor Charlie Lee, the piano thumper, was mentioned in the Kansas City Leavenworth Herald newspaper. Then, in 1910, the pioneering musicologist John Lomax received a partial transcription at the Library of Congress from a woman in Texas. It was for a song called The Ballad of Stagger Lee, which she claimed was, quote, "sung by the Negroes on the levee while they are loading and unloading the river freighters. For this to be true, the news of Stagger Lee had made its way into field hollers and other work songs performed by African-American laborers along the Mississippi River and convicts on Southern chain gangs before being sung in saloons by street singers and eventually on the radio. The first recording of hundreds to come of Stagger Lee came in 1923 as a hit instrumental piece by Fred Waring's Pennsylvanians as Stacko Lee Blues. The first version that included lyrics was recorded in 1924 as Skeega Lee Blues, done in a classic blues format by singer and bandleader Lovey Austin, which you're hearing now. The following year, the mother of the blues, Ma Rainey and Louis Armstrong, recorded their version under Stacko Lee Blues, with the melody and music paralleling another popular murder ballad called Frankie and Johnny. Then in 1927, Piedmont blues guitarist Frank Hutchinson laid down Stacko Lee, which was included in Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music compilation. It was a version recorded by folk and blues musician Mississippi John Hurt in 1928, however, that is widely regarded in the root scene as the gold standard.
Police officer, how can it be? You can arrest everybody but cruel Stagger Lee, that bad man, oh cruel Stagger Lee.
Over the years, many have speculated where Lee's nickname stems from, and whether or not it was in fact Stag Lee or Stack Lee. Some say he went Stag, or friendless, whereas blues pioneer W.C. Handy thought the name Stack came from smokestacks, as a reference to a tall person, though Lee was only 5'7". Both John and Alan Lomax have deciphered that Lee got the nickname sometime during his youth from a Memphis riverboat called the Stack Lee, known for its onboard prostitution. Because of this ambiguity, titles of the song have fallen victim to the folk tradition, where even the earliest and modern versions can have several different spellings while pronouncing Stack-a-Lee, Stacker-Lee, Stag-o-Lee, and Stagger-Lee.
Stag-a-Lee said, Billy, man, don't take my life. I got two lovely children. I got a very lovely wife. Talking about the bad man. Cruel old Stagger-Lee.
Now well over a century since the murder, the identity of the killer known as Stagger Lee has shifted, and American popular culture has affectionately made it an outlaw story. The folklore doesn't stand alone in making it one of the most popular murder ballads still around. Chiefly, Stagger Lee has been one of the most widely adapted in America's history, having been reinvented in work chants, field hollers, blues, Broadway show tunes, honky-tonk, country, ragtime, jazz, 50s rock and roll, hip-hop, ska, pop, folk music, musicals, poems, novels, and even a risque feature film. Since its first recording in 1923, more than 400 different artists have documented their take, including Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington, James Brown, Bob Dylan, Woody Guthrie, Doc Watson, Pete Seeger, Taj Mahal, Elton John, The Grateful Dead, The Black Keys, and The Clash. Simply put, no other song has transcended its origin story and been renewed by such a wealth of genres, multimedia formats, and by so many artists, while at the same time remaining relatively obscure.
Had a great big fight talking about that bad man, cruel old Stagger Lee.
Hey folks, some of you have already listened to the episode that I shared from the Basic Folk podcast a few weeks ago, featuring a conversation with hosts Cindy Howes and Chris Thiele, but I wanted to reiterate how much I love this show, and since you listen to American Songcatcher, I think you will too. Cindy Howes is a well-versed public radio host and a music curator with decades of experience who approaches interviews with warmth, humor, and insightful questions. Every week she has complex conversations about the human experience, witnessed from an artistic angle, with many of the top names in American roots music today. You can hear over 150 talks with the likes of Amethyst Kia, MC Taylor from His Golden Messenger, Anais Mitchell, Trey Burt, Tom Resch, Oliver Wood, Allison Russell, and many, many more. Subscribe to Basic Folk wherever you get your podcasts. I highly recommend it. You're listening to American Songcatcher.
Who do, lady? How do you do? Tell me you take a boot and turn to a brand new shoe. But don't put that thing on me. Don't put that thing on me.
Born in Mississippi and raised in the second oldest neighborhood of New Orleans, Algiers, Louisiana, Lizzie Douglas, better known as Memphis Minnie, Queen of the Country Blues, came into the world on June 3, 1887. The oldest of 13 and affectionately named Kid by her family, Minnie grew up at a time when Algiers was a major industrial hub. It played host to hundreds of immigrant families from Germany, Ireland, and Italy, in addition to the African American community, all of whom worked on ships and stockyards, slaughterhouses, and at the sprawling rail yard. To appease the array of working families, Algiers also hosted over 40 bars and dance halls, producing a vibrant cultural stew of music, such as pioneers of early jazz, like trumpeter Oscar Papa Celestine. When Minnie was 7, the family relocated to a small farming community in Walls, Mississippi, about 20 miles south of Memphis. The musical veins of Algiers had buried itself in the defiant and fiercely independent young girl, so for her first Christmas in Tennessee, Minnie asked for a guitar. 2 years later, by age 10, she had learned to play the banjo as well and started performing at parties. Minnie was constantly running away from home, landing on the music mecca of downtown Memphis, Beale Street. With a guitar in hand, known as Kid Douglas, she learned the ropes of performing before adolescence. At 13, she left home to busk on street corners full-time, living a cutthroat and hard life of homelessness that required her to grow up fast. Alongside the jug bands and string bands on Beale Street, she quickly made a name for herself and developed a reputation as a tough kid who was prodigious on the guitar. Throughout her teens, Minnie would occasionally return to the farm if she ran out of money, but kept at it on Beale Street and nearby parks, cafes, clubs, boat rides, house parties, and dances, occasionally with local players like Delta-style guitarist Willie Brown. At 19 years old, she was invited on a tent show tour through the South with the Ringling Brothers Circus as a traveling musician, where she learned a great deal of showmanship from 1916 to 1920 before returning to Memphis. The blues scene of the 1920s had already been happening when Minnie left, but became more popular on her return. One could hear a plethora of jug bands, ragtime, early jazz, country blues, and string bands on the streets, and the Tin Pan Alley and vaudeville blues singers like Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey were taking over the African-American record market, while men dominated the stages of juke joints and nightclubs. Beale Street was one of the first places in the country where women were allowed to perform in public, though in order to make ends meet, several of them supplemented their income with prostitution, including Minnie, which was common at the time.
When he got me an alley, called me a name. What I put on it was a crying shame down in this alley.
Relentless in promoting her career, Minnie played with jug bands, by herself in clubs and on street corners, and as a duo with Willie Brown, until she started performing with Delta Blues singer and guitarist Joe McCoy, whom she married in 1929. That same year, a talent scout ran into them playing for nickels and dimes in front of a barbershop and invited them to New York. They made their first recordings that year under the names Kansas Joe and Memphis Minnie, which was given to them by a Columbia A&R rep. Their first single was When the Levee Breaks, with the other side as That Will Be All Right, both with Kansas Joe on vocals and Minnie leading on guitar.
Keeps on red, levee's going to break.
A Over the next 5 years, Memphis Minnie and Kansas Joe released several sides that sold moderately well on a wide variety of labels, such as Columbia, Vocalion, OK, and Decca Records, and had a few hit songs like Bumblebee.
Bumblebee, Bumblebee, please come back to me. Bumblebee, Bumblebee, please come back to me.
In 1930, along with many other successful and struggling musicians, the couple relocated to the epicenter of the blues at the time, Chicago. The entire country had been in the grips of the Great Depression, and great solace was found in the blues and jazz clubs around town. Their arrival was timely, and along with Tampa Red and Big Bill Brunzi, they had helped introduce authentic country blues into the budding scene, particularly Minnie, who was seen as a pioneer. Despite poor sales due to the recession, they continued recording together until Joe's jealousy of Minnie's acclaim and success got the best of their relationship, which led to divorce in 1935. Their last recording together was a two-part track titled, You Got to Move, You Ain't Got to Move.
Look here, baby, you ain't got to go. I've got my first time to drive you from my door. You ain't got to move.
Minnie's lifelong friendship with the king of Chicago blues, Big Bill Brunzi, first started with a cutting contest, also known as a guitar challenge. As the legend goes, according to Brunzi's autobiography, Big Bill Blues, in a Chicago nightclub on June 26, 1933, each musician performed two songs, with first prize being a bottle of whiskey and a bottle of gin. Big Bill played Just a Dream and Make My Getaway, while Minnie won the audience over with Me and My Chauffeur Blues and Looking the World Over. He went on to say that Minnie could, quote, pick a guitar and sing as good as any man I've ever heard. And thus, a secondary title as the Queen of Chicago Blues was born. After separating from Kansas Joe, Minnie was out on her own and began performing with a full backup band that included piano, bass, and drums. She recorded four sides in 1935 under the name Texas Tessie, and later that year, she penned two songs paying tribute to boxing champion Joe Louis, titled He's in the Ring, Doing That Same Old Thing, and the Joe Louis Strut. She collaborated with the Memphis Jug Band, and during the late 1930s and early 1940s, Minnie was experimenting with some of the earliest electrically amplified guitars, and may have been one of the first blues musicians to record on the instrument. Around the same time, Minnie also began working with the most powerful manager in the blues business of the decade, a man named Lester Melrose. Their personalities were contrasting, and many believed that he stifled Minnie's restless and free spirit, and that his guidance softened her otherwise hard-driving electric guitar with his commercial mindset. By 1939, Minnie started recording with a guitarist named Ernest Lawlers, who performed under the name Little Son Joe. They were married in 1942 and would remain together for the rest of their lives. Joe can be heard on some of Minnie's most celebrated songs from the 1940s and 50s, such as 1941's Me and My Chauffeur Blues, which you're hearing right now, Nothing in Ramblin', Killer Diller, and her last commercial recording in 1953, Kissing in the Dark.
Call the doctor, call him quick. I done got something about to make me sick. I've been kissing in the dark. Yeah, kissing in the dark.
In the mid-1950s, as the growing interest in acoustic blues mounted, Minnie's health began to fail, and she was unable to take part. Instead, she stuck to a few clubs around Chicago until her last performance at a memorial concert for her longtime friend, Big Bill Brunzi, in 1958. Afterward, she and Joe returned to Memphis, where she became a mentor of sorts, encouraging the next generation of blues artists. Despite her career lasting over 20 years, Minnie's retirement nearly left her penniless. In 1960, she suffered a stroke and was confined to a wheelchair. In the following year, her husband, Little Son Joe, passed away. Minnie was too poor to afford a nursing home, so her sister took on primary care. When the news of her dire situation and relief requests circulated through magazines like Living Blues and Blues Unlimited, many fans sent money, and several musicians raised funds through benefit concerts. Minnie was admitted to a nursing home in the mid-1960s, just as many of her LPs were being reissued to new audiences. After suffering a second stroke on August 6, 1973, Memphis Minnie passed away at the age of 86. Minnie's family wasn't able to afford a headstone for her grave. And so, just like so many African-American musicians born around the turn of the century, she was buried in an unmarked grave at the New Hope Cemetery in Walls, Mississippi. It wasn't until 23 years after her death in 1996, with aid from the Mount Zion Memorial Fund, which was founded by John Fogerty and Bonnie Raitt, that a proper headstone was placed at her grave. Etched into the stone, it reads, "The hundreds of sides Minnie recorded are the perfect material to teach us about the blues. For the blues are at once general and particular, speaking for millions, but in a highly singular, individual voice. Listening to Minnie's songs, we hear her fantasies, her dreams, her desires, but we will hear them as if they were our own."
Ain't no doctor, but I'm the doctor wife. You better come to me if you wanna save your life. He's a dirty mother for you.
For nearly three decades, Memphis Minnie overcame the odds of poverty, homelessness, racism, and sexism to become one of the most influential blues artists in history. Not only that, she contributed a great deal to the development of Chicago's urban and electric blues, and what later would become rhythm and blues and rock and roll. She released more than 180 songs in her career, as well as posthumously, which was very rare for female blues singers of the day. Deeply inspired by Ma Rainey, Minnie's stage presence, self-confidence, stylish wardrobe, powerful voice, extremely wide repertoire, and toughness christened her as a champion of female empowerment. Minnie was known to constantly chew tobacco, even while singing or playing the guitar, and always had a cup nearby to spit in. And according to blues musician Johnny Shines, quote, "Any man fool with her, she'd go for them right away. She didn't take no foolishness off them. Guitar, pocket knife, pistol, anything she'd get her hand on, she'd use it."
Well, the ugliest little thing I ever seen before. He didn't favor tramp, he's a hobo, but he's a ugly little something on a scowl. He's a terrible little something, hush your mouth. He's an awful little creature, he's a killer dealer from the south.
Today, Memphis Minnie's inventive, rhythmic guitar playing and songwriting are still celebrated among acoustic blues and early Chicago blues enthusiasts, though her influence doesn't stop there. Her songs have been recorded by Big Mama Thornton, Muddy Waters, B.B. King, Elmore James, Bob Wills, Jefferson Airplane, Led Zeppelin, and Lucinda Williams, among others. In 1980, Minnie was among the first 20 musicians to be inducted into the Blues Hall of Fame, and along with Bessie Smith, was the only woman included.
Well, he walked in a hotel. Everybody left. He looked in his glass and he smiled himself. I'm a little baby on a scowl. I'm a terrible little something, hush your mouth. I'm an awful little creature. I'm a killer dealer from the south.
You're listening to American Songcatcher.
This morning I woke up this morning. Yes, poor lightning, show us, please.
In a small farm town that lies directly between Dallas and Houston, Sam Hopkins, prominently known as Lightning Hopkins, was born on March 12, 1912, in Centerville, Texas. One of five brothers and a sister, his father was a musician who immersed Sam and his siblings in the early sounds of the blues. But when Sam was just 3 or 4 years old, his father was killed because of a card game. After his passing, Sam's mother moved the family about 8 miles south to Leona, Texas, where he grew up working in the cotton fields under the hot Texas sun during the height of the Jim Crow era. Inspired by the music that his father left behind, at 8 years old, Sam nailed some plank wood to a cigar box and strung up either screen or chicken wire for strings to make a guitar, and his older brothers showed him the basic chords.
She told me late last night, you don't need no mama no
how. That same year, the Hopkins family was attending a picnic at a Baptist Church Association meeting in Buffalo, Texas, highlighted by a performance from gospel singer and father of the Texas blues, Blind Lemon Jefferson. 8-year-old Sam supposedly joined in from behind the platform stage with his homemade guitar. Angry at first, Jefferson stopped playing and called for the mystery guitar player to show himself. After learning that Sam was just a young boy, Jefferson softened and told him to keep going, as long as he could, quote, play it right, and his first guitar lesson was underway. Sam would later claim that ever since that day, he had felt the blues was in him.
Whoa, go bring my shotgun. Oh, lightning gonna start a shooting again.
As Sam became more proficient, his performances alongside his mentor, Blind Lemon Jefferson, increased at informal church gatherings, local picnics, and evening performances. Aside from his time performing with Leadbelly in the 1920s on the streets of Deep Ellum in Dallas, Jefferson apparently never let anyone else play alongside him besides Sam. As was common for a young, black man in Texas at the time, Sam dropped out of school and started a short stint working on a plantation during the day with family while performing occasionally in the evenings. He later recalled, "I did a little plowing, not too much, chopped a little cotton, pulled a little corn, I did a little of it all." That path was only temporary, however, as he would later state, "Chop that cotton for 6 bits a day, plow that mule for 6 bits a day, that wasn't in storage for me."
Double barrel shotgun, it just won't fire.
By age 10, Sam was leaving home more frequently and going as far as Dallas to meet with Jefferson before he began learning from his distant cousin, country blues singer Algier Texas Alexander. Soon after, along with his cousin, Sam spent the second half of the 1920s hoboing around Texas, jumping trains, shooting dice, and accompanying his boisterous cousin on the streets, at picnics, parties, and dances, often just for tips, then returning home with the little money that they made. These were formidable years for Sam, learning to stand out, sing and shout, and entertain.
It seemed funny, baby, you got other things on your mind, but you can't quit me, there's no need of trying.
When he was 18, Sam married a woman named Diamond Elmer Lacey and tried to settle down in Leona with a steady job picking cotton and corn once again while performing every Friday and Saturday night at local plantations. They were hired to work for Tom Moore, who listeners may recall from Mance Lipscomb's story in episode 1 of season 2. Just like his longtime friend Mance, Sam would immortalize Tom's cold-blooded ways in song with Tom Moore's blues.
You know that's when I moved my wife and family. I moved him down on Minnetomo's phone.
By the mid-1930s, however, after 4 children, either Diamond was fed up with Sam's wandering lifestyle, took the children and left, or Sam just up and decided to leave.
You know, I hate to go down, I hate to go down this lonesome road. Hate to go down this lonesome road by myself.
Around this time, Sam was sentenced to do time on a country road chain gang. Some sources say that it was for committing adultery with a white woman, while Sam claimed that he, quote, had to cut an old boy. He learned work songs that would manifest into his own lyrics and added to his story collection, like how the same judge that sent him to the chain gang would later cut him loose after Sam sang him a song about how bad and how sad to be a fool. In 1939, Sam relocated to the Third Ward area of Houston, where he would remain nearly the rest of his life. He got a job laying track and rail ties at Missouri Pacific Railroad, though that didn't last long, and soon he resumed gambling, playing guitar, and bootlegging.
Trouble in mind, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always.
Sam would set up shop in the bustling area of Dowling Street and take his guitar on the buses that transported blacks, and was often permitted to ride for free, providing that he played for his fellow passengers. He'd play requests of standards like Trouble in Mind, or make something up, and scrounge up enough change to pay for a meal, maybe some whiskey, and a roll of the dice. Eventually, he played his way into tiny juke joints, developing a unique reputation with his flair for theatrics on stage, from clowning around, inflating stories, dancing, to playing guitar while laying on the ground, or bantering with the crowd, and rarely doing a song the same way twice. He occasionally rejoined forces with his cousin Texas Alexander around the Houston bar circuit in eastern Texas, and despite the plethora of performances, Sam was chronically short of money.
Now she done messed up with another man, and she won't pay me no mind, you know I feel so bad.
In 1946, Lola Ann Cullum, a talent scout working for Aladdin Records, spotted Sam performing either on Dowling Street or at Third Ward Bar, and asked him to make the journey to LA and record. Sam had recently been performing with a pianist named Wilson Thunder Smith, and the two got on a train to LA, where they and a drummer recorded songs like Feel So Bad, which you're hearing now, That Mean Old Twister, Can't Do Like He Used To, and West Coast Blues. The record company billed the pair as Thunder and Lightning, and so, from then on, Sam was known as Lightning Hopkins.
Listen good so you know what I'm talking about.
I don't want no ever having no long one, man.
A year later, back in Houston, Lightning started working with the small Gold Star label, along with his brother Joel, and re-recorded two songs from that first Aladdin session, including Short-Haired Woman, which sold 40,000 copies and became his first hit. Over the following 3 years, nearly all 36 songs that he would record with Gold Star would do well, most notably the widely known tune Baby Please Don't Go, which sold 80,000 copies.
Baby, please don't go. Baby, please don't go. Baby, please don't go back to New Orleans. You know I love you so, baby, please don't go.
As invitations to New York came in and producers lined up in Houston to record him, Lightning refused to sign any contract and required a cash payment for every song that he performed in the studio, preferably beforehand. Producers would note that he was relentlessly efficient, usually needing no more than one take to cut any given track. Oftentimes, he'd record slightly different versions of the same song for record companies that were competing with each other, and this era would see Lightning record with over 20 different labels over his 50-year career. Between 1946 and 1951, he was prolific, with nearly 150 sides, and though his records only sold well in Texas initially, by the early 1950s, his music could be found all over the country in black communities, and Lightning Hopkins became synonymous with the likes of Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker.
You know my starter won't start this morning. You know my motor won't even turn.
Lightning grabbed more success on Billboard's rhythm and blues charts with songs like T-Model Blues and Coffee Blues that helped fuel the advancing electric blues sound, as well as rock and roll. As the genre began to take hold, a declining interest in acoustic blues left many record companies to follow the trend. As opportunities dwindled, Lightning stopped recording as a popular artist in 1956 and carried on with his life in the Third Ward.
Father, help me. Help me, Jesus, if you please.
Yes, I'm just a poor boy traveling.
In ironic fashion, just 3 years later, as a great folk revival was burgeoning, Lightning was, quote, rediscovered by preservationist Mac McCormick, who had seen him perform in the streets of Houston years earlier. Producer Sam Charters of Folkways Records, who also authored a book in 1969 titled The Country Blues that gave a rich and vital perspective to the early roots of African-American acoustic blues music and featured Lightning Hopkins, invited him to record. With a borrowed acoustic guitar, McCormick asked Lightning to record as he used to, stripped down, and indicated that these recordings would be marketed to young white audiences. Lightning was hesitant. Having been burned by producers before, like many other blues singers that were being rediscovered, he didn't think white people were interested in what he had to say, as the blues that he knew was entirely of black experience and black expression. The self-titled album propelled Lightning back into the limelight. And for his first show back, McCormick booked him at the Houston Folklore and Folk Music Society Hootenanny. Having never done a concert in front of 300 mostly white people sitting down the entire time, Lightning was nervous beforehand. But on stage, he was cast under the blues spell, churning out songs about chain gangs, mules, women, hard traveling, and telling stories. The audience was enamored. A second prolific phase of recording began, penning 10 records over the following 4 years. He joined a bill at Carnegie Hall with Joan Baez and Pete Seeger, and was soon on stage in California at the Berkeley Folk Festival.
I just love to be around you. And this way of speaking, I just love the audience. Period, but I can't see them all. That's a man. Oh, I like, what? I live, boy. Looking better than anything I ever seen tonight, but I see. Well, that's all right.
Lightning toured Europe in 1964 alongside Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, John Lee Hooker, and Sonny Boy Williamson for the American Folk Blues Festival, and before the end of the decade would open for rock bands like the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. In 1967, after appearing at the prestigious Newport Folk Festival, Lightning was featured by filmmaker Les Blank in that year's The Sun's Gonna Shine documentary and the follow-up short documentary The Blues According to Lightning Hopkins, which won the award for Best Documentary at the Chicago Film Festival in 1970. The interview in that latter film was recorded the same day that Lightning's wife had left him after a heated argument, while her cousin stood outside his apartment, armed with a pistol because of what was said. Lightning also had a gun on him, yet remained unaffected, and when he was asked what the blues meant to him, he answered like this.
Because the blues is something that people can't get rid of. Yeah. And if you ever have the blues, remember what I tell you. You'll always hear this in your heart. That's the blues.
During the 1970s, despite his distaste for flying, Lightning caught a fast pace, touring and performing internationally at festivals in Canada, Europe, and Japan. While in Europe, he claims to have been invited for a Royal Command performance for Queen Elizabeth II and recalled telling her, "Queen Lady, I'm sure glad to meet you, and if you just sit down over there, you'll hear something you ain't never heard before." And so I backed up and sat down on a stool and hit that first note so hard, you could hear it clean across the water. His old ways stuck with him, in spite of his growing acclaim, and was hard to track down, as he refused to own a telephone and reportedly would turn down tour offers of $2,000 a week to play in small bars in Houston for $17 a night.
Trouble, trouble, trouble. Trouble is all in the world I see.
During the last half of the 70s, Lightning mostly gigged and stuck around Houston. He hired a driver named Michael Point, who saw a different side of Lightning than most, recalling, he'd be out on the porch with all these neighborhood kids around him, and he'd be playing a kid's concert for them, all cheerful and positive, Sesame Street versions of his songs. After being diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus, Lightning underwent surgery in the summer of 1981 and was forced to cancel a 2-week European tour due to weakness. His last performance was a sold-out 2-night run at a venue called Tramps in New York City that fall. He was admitted for additional treatment and passed away of pneumonia brought on by the cancer on January 30th, 1982, at age 69.
You know the rain is falling.
I can see it all on my window pane.
By the time of his passing, Lightnin' Hopkins' music was widely celebrated. Yet beyond being from East Texas, and that he seemed to epitomize the blues with the dark sunglasses, gold teeth, and half pint of whiskey or gin in his back pocket, who he was as a person was cloaked in mystery. Through interviews with friends, foes, family, and the man himself, it was learned that he spent most of his life living alone and roaming the streets around Houston, that his appetite for gambling and drinking was insatiable, and he threw most of his money away, that he often borrowed guitars to perform, that he was stubborn, ornery, flashy, and capable of both great inspiration and self-sabotaging destruction.
Now meet me in the bottom and bring my boots and shoes. Tonight's your mama, great God Almighty now. Meet me in the bottom and bring my boots and shoes.
Though he never saw himself as a songwriter, through 30 years of recording, Lightnin' Hopkins had a body of work that encompassed somewhere between 500 and 700 songs and over 85 albums, more than any of his blues contemporaries, past or present. Lightnin' claimed that he wrote every song that he played, though it's been debated that he's likely violated more copyrights than anyone in history, and even flat-out stole some songs, such as Big Joe Williams's Baby Please Don't Go, as well as Blind Lemon Jefferson's See That My Grave Is Kept Clean, which he retitled One Kind of Favor. He'd record for anyone that paid him beforehand, and would call a song new if he changed some verses. Regardless, Lightnin' was an unrivaled entertainer in every sense of the word, capable of making up an entire set's worth of material any given day, which often proved difficult for his accompanying musicians to follow, causing Lightnin' to flash them a dirty look. Sam Lightnin' Hopkins was one of the last direct links to the old acoustic blues tradition, who also played a key role in the transition from country to urban electric blues. He's been cited as a major influence on the likes of Townes Van Zandt, Stevie Ray Vaughan, B.B. King, Jimmy Vaughan, Guy Clark, The Grateful Dead, and Jimi Hendrix, who got interested in blues music after listening to Lightnin' Hopkins' records with his father. Today, a statue stands of Lightnin' Hopkins in Crockett, Texas. He's been honored in the Texas Music Hall of Fame, and in 1980 was inducted into the Blues Foundation Hall of Fame. This story was written with assistance from Jack Browning.
You're not just crossed over that Mason-Dixon line.
Hey folks, some of you may have noticed that there are no longer recordings of my renditions in the episodes. I've decided to offer full versions of those songs exclusively to our supporters on Patreon. If you didn't already know, American Songcatcher is an independent program that needs funding to continue forward. If you learned or felt something from this show, please consider joining the Patreon or sending a one-time donation at the links in the show notes of this episode. Thank you so much for listening. You're listening to American Songcatcher.
Got a bird, what a whistle. Baby got a bird, honey got a bird, we'll sing.
In the Upper Manhattan historic neighborhood of Harlem, New York, Henry St. Clair Fredericks, Jr., known by many as Taj Mahal, came into the world on May 17, 1942. Henry was born right on the heels of the Harlem Renaissance movement of the 1920s and 1930s, when black culture and the African-American experience in America was examined and celebrated. Growing up in a musical family, with both parents as musicians, Henry was encouraged to pursue his musical interests starting in childhood. His mother was a school teacher from South Carolina who sang the gospel, and his father, Henry Sr., was a jazz pianist and composer from the Caribbean West Indies, who had built a reputation for himself in the New York jazz scene during the Renaissance. An educated and cultured man, Henry Sr. spoke seven languages, including Yiddish, and wrote compositions for the King of Swing, Benny Goodman, and was given the nickname The Genius by legendary jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald. Both of Henry's parents held a deep reverence for their African roots and instilled that appreciation in him and his four siblings. As he said, quote, "I was connected with my African ancestry through my parents' stories. My grandparents on my father's side came to this country from the Caribbean with a strong connection to Africa and no shame about it. As I got more involved in music, one of the things that made me excited from the time that I was a child was that clear link between our ancestors and the sounds that we hear today."
Jump in the line, rock your body young time. Jump in the line, rock your body young time.
Much of Henry's childhood in New York was spent absorbing the eclectic musical influence of his parents, from gospel to blues to different styles of island music, as well as a good deal of classical and opera. Around 7 years old, he was listening to his father's shortwave radio, captivated by the popular sounds of Mahalia Jackson, Ray Charles, Ella Fitzgerald, as well as Hawaiian music, which at the time resonated more deeply than any other music that he'd listened to. Henry would also peruse his parents' record collection that held big band, jazz, and swing music, and he discovered blues artists such as W.C. Handy, Leadbelly, Sunhouse, and Sleepy John Estes. As a teenager, Henry became enchanted with the upbeat, blues-based stylings of rock and roll guitarists like Chuck Berry, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, and Bo Diddley, and began studying artists like Big Mama Thornton, Howlin' Wolf, and Mississippi John Hurt, who long before had been giving a voice to marginalized Black Americans.
I shall not be moved, just like a tree planted by the water. I shall not be moved.
In the early 1950s, the family relocated to the industrial city of Springfield, Massachusetts. Due to the high volume of production and manufacturing, as well as the many educational opportunities, Springfield was home to an array of immigrants from around the globe, who all brought their own culture and musical traditions, which Henry soaked up. In 1954, when he was 12 years old, tragedy struck when Henry's father was killed suddenly in an accident while working at a construction site. A few years later, his mother remarried a talented musician from the island of Jamaica. Though he wasn't classically trained like Henry's father, his stepfather helped him see the merit in acquiring musical ability without formal training.
Bet you're going fishing all of the time, baby going fishing too. Bet your life, your sweet wife, will catch more fish than you.
To help the healing process of losing his father, Henry turned to music and farming. Working the land proved to be a therapeutic endeavor and granted him the opportunity to study agriculture and animal husbandry at the University of Massachusetts, with a minor in veterinary science and agronomy. He'd later recall, quote, "I knew I'd like to connect myself to something on this planet that's meaningful. That's why I was interested in agriculture and music. Those were the two things that I recognized, even as a very young child, that people are never going to do without." It was there in college, after a period of self-reflection and studying Indian history and philosophy, that Henry took on the moniker Taj Mahal.
Champagne don't drive me crazy.
Cocaine don't make me lazy. Ain't nobody's business but my own.
You know, candy's then and liquor is quicker.
You can drink all the liquor down in Costa Rica, baby. Ain't nobody's business but your own.
In the early 1960s, Taj formed his own band, known as Taj Mahal and the Electras, a seven-piece R&B group who quickly gained popularity in the central Massachusetts area and along the East Coast, especially around college campuses. With this group, Taj began to hone in his prowess as a frontman, learning to interact with the audience and engage through performing. After graduating from UMass, Taj decided to dedicate himself to music full-time. In 1964, at the height of the folk and blues revivals, Taj moved to Los Angeles, California, where he befriended an 18-year-old blues guitarist named Rye Cooter. Rye's guitar playing was more advanced than anyone else that Taj had encountered by that point, and not long after meeting, Taj and Rye Cooter formed the five-piece blues group, The Rising Suns.
1, 2, 3, 4!
The Rising Suns quickly became popular in California, playing an eclectic mix of folk, blues, and rock and roll to audiences eager to hear modern twists on traditional folk and blues sounds, covering songs from a variety of artists ranging from Bob Dylan and Carole King to early blues artists like Robert Johnson and Charlie Patton. They eventually struck a deal with Columbia Records and only recorded one album, which wasn't released by Columbia for another 30 years due to tensions between the band and the record company. Despite their short-lived success, the Rising Suns were a major stepping stone for the futures of both Taj and Rye. Taj's solo career began, initially working as a studio musician for Columbia until 1968, when, with the help of session guitarist Jesse Davis and Rye Cooter, Taj released his self-titled debut album with Columbia Records. His first few albums showcased his talents not only as a blues musician, but as an original composer, and especially for his ability to breathe new life into old traditional blues music. In the mid-1960s, at the famous Whiskey A Go-Go in Los Angeles, he caught the attention of another groundbreaking blues act touring through the area, the Rolling Stones. That led to Taj being featured in the Stones' 1968 film, Rolling Stones' Rock and Roll Circus.
You got to dig it, baby! Yes, 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 you know the desert could not hold all the love that I have in my heart for you.
During the 1970s, Taj's traditionally based blues music began taking on a more island-infused tone, which hinted at Taj's exploration of his own Caribbean heritage. In 1974, he released his seventh studio album, Mo Roots, which featured covers such as Desperate Love by Jamaican songwriter Bob Andy and Slave Driver by Bob Marley and the Wailers, with co-production credits by both Bob Marley and Aston Barrett of the Wailers.
Slave driver, the tables are turning. Catch a fire, you're going to get burned now.
In an interview with the New York Times in 1973, Taj explained that, quote, "What I'm doing is presenting the music from an intelligent black viewpoint, from a musicologist's standpoint, historically, from love and out of respect." Throughout the coming decades, Taj helped to strengthen the black voice and tell the story of the black experience in America through music as well as film. A year prior, in 1972, Taj performed in his first commercially successful film, playing the role of Ike Phillips in the movie Sounder, about a family of African-American sharecroppers in the Depression-era South. Taj also composed the score for the film, becoming the first country blues musician to do so for a major motion picture. Four years later, in 1977, Taj worked on the biographical film Scott Joplin, detailing how the famous composer became known as the father of ragtime. Toward the end of the decade, Taj and his band were asked by the State Department of the Jimmy Carter administration to serve as cultural ambassadors to Africa, since the band had worked with so many artists and performers from cultures and backgrounds all over the world. They were booked as the Taj Mahal International Rhythm Band and played for 3 months across 12 countries in Central and West Africa. Throughout the 1980s, Taj continued to expand his career as well as his musical sound, holding a deep, lifelong passion for Hawaiian music since first hearing it played through his father's radio as a child. Taj moved to the island of Kauai, Hawaii, in 1981, and soon formed the Hula Blues Band.
Oh, twinkling wheel, can't see the red roads when the streets are
following year, in 1988, Taj released his first children's music album, titled Shake Sugary, inspired by the 1967 album of the same name by Piedmont blues guitarist Elizabeth Cotton. Shake Sugary featured children's songs, such as Funky Bluesy ABCs and Kwave Kwave, a song from Gambia and Senegal that tells the story of a traveling fruit salesman. Guave goes up late on Yammy, East Aligambia, Chuyantana. Guave Guave goes up late on Yammy, East Aligambia, Chuyantana. In the 80s and 90s, Taj became involved with charity organizations such as Farm Aid and the Music Maker Relief Foundation, performing at fundraising concerts around the United States and headlining festivals that support these organizations and other worthy causes. He also continued working in the film industry, composing the score for the 1992 film Zebrahead, and in 1999, he played the part of Dexter Speaks for the film Songcatcher, which was set in Appalachian Kentucky during the early 20th century and tells the story of Professor Olive Dame Campbell collecting Appalachian ballads with origins in the British Isles.
Months of May, when all gay flowers were blooming, Sweet William on his deathbed lay for the love of Barbary Allen. He sent his
the long crested hunting hawk eagle, the master hunter.
The 90s also found Taj breaking new ground musically. In 1999, he teamed up with West African musician Toumani Diabaté and six other musicians from Mali to release Kulanjan, which celebrates the connection between West African music and the blues, named Album of the Year by Folk Magazine. In 1995, along with Indian musicians Vishnu Mohan Bhatt and Nadasimhan Ravikiran, Taj released the album Mumtaz Mahal. The album title pays homage to the wife of a 17th century Persian emperor and is one of the only documented attempts to fuse traditional blues and American folk music with Indian classical music.
Ding dong the road with the pistol in your way, Johnny, you're too bad. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
The 1990s additionally brought the formal recognition of Taj's large body of work from the music industry at large. Over the course of the decade, he was nominated for 8 Grammys, and in 1997 won his first Grammy for Best Contemporary Blues Album for Señor Blues, and manifested perhaps his most well-known song, Queen Bee. The following year, he released Sacred Island with the Hula Blues Band, which hit the top 5 on the Billboard charts and captured the essence of Taj's beloved home away from home, Hawaii. In the 2000s, Taj continued expanding his interpretations of blues roots and other forms of world music, securing another Grammy win for the live album Shoutin' in Key in 2000. The release of Taj's 26th album, Maestro, in 2008 marked the 40th anniversary of his solo career and featured artists that influenced and were influenced by Taj, including Los Lobos, Ziggy Marley, Jack Johnson, and several others. In 2013, along with his daughter Deva's group, Fredericks Brown, Taj headlined the World Blues Tour, which was put together as a celebration of American blues music and its influence on diverse forms of international music. 4 years later, the first collaboration with blues songwriter Keb Mo, called Taj Mo, was unveiled, winning the 2018 Grammy Award for Best Contemporary Blues Album.
If the real world whiskey and I was a diving duck, oh, if the real world whiskey, I was a diving duck.
Since the early 2000s, Taj has also been a prominent participant and supporter of the Playing for Change Foundation, an organization dedicated to inspiring and connecting the world through music and creating music programs for marginalized and at-risk youth in developing countries. Taj says that the blues can be found anywhere, regardless of the country of origin or the background of the person playing. The blues is a human experience. Quote, "The blues is bigger than most people," he said. "You could hear Mozart playing the blues. It might be more of a lament. It might be more melancholy. But I'm going to tell you, The blues is in there.
Baby, and I never come up.
Through his varied philanthropic missions and spreading the awareness of how versatile and influential African heritage is, Taj Mahal remains one of the most highly regarded figures in blues and roots music today. Over his 60-year career, Taj has dedicated his life to being a liaison between traditions, connecting the cultural dots around the world, and using music to help them identify with one another. From the kingdoms of West Africa to the Black experience in the American South, from the idyllic islands of Hawaii to the ancient cities of India, and from the rich, vibrant cultures of Latin America to the Caribbean islands to nearly everything in between. He's been cited as a direct inspiration for acts such as the Allman Brothers, Phish, Ben Harper, Lettuce, Grace Potter, Jack Johnson, and countless others. Taj was named the official blues artist of Massachusetts, has won Blues Music Awards and 3 Grammys, and was given the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Americana Music Association in 2014. This story was written by Ryan Eastridge.
People say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16.
That's all for episode 5 of season 2, honoring Black History Month. You can now follow American Songcatcher on Instagram and TikTok at American Songcatcher. And those of you using Apple Podcasts, please give a rating and a review. It helps us out a lot. Today's Shine a Light goes out to the Blues Foundation. The Blues Foundation preserves blues heritage, celebrates blues recordings and performances, expands worldwide awareness of the blues, and ensures the future of the uniquely American art form. The Blues Foundation seeks to open the hearts, minds, and talent of new generations to the possibilities found in the blues. Learn more at blues.org or visit the show notes for this episode. Huge thanks to the community on Patreon. This would not be possible without you. To Smithsonian Folkways for all their crucial work in preserving the legacy of these artists and these songs, the Library of Congress's complete National Recording Registry and Archive of Folk Song. Our intro song is Payday by Mississippi John Hurt from the Today album. Our outro song is 16 Tons, performed by Tennessee Ernie Ford, originally written by Merle Travis. This episode was produced, researched, edited, recorded, and distributed by myself, Nicholas Edward Williams, with writing assistance from Jack Browning and Ryan Eastridge. In the words of Lightnin' Hopkins, people have learned how to strum a guitar, but they don't feel it from the heart. I'm killing myself to tell them how it is. Here's to the songs of old. May they live on forever. See you next time on American Songcatcher.
Step aside. A lot of men didn't. A lot of men died. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.